Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, may the 4th be with you. Padre SJ is with me. We're going to talk a bit about smart contracts, Princess Leia as a prisoner of war, what to do if there is a Westworld doppelganger of you, and much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 421, recorded May the 4th, 2018. Doing not. Hi, folks, and may the 4th be with you. It is May the 4th, and we are doing This Week in Law. Although the force has not been strong with this episode, I must confess up front, there are some wonderful silver linings, though, to the exploding planet that has been episode 421 of This Week in Law thus far. The two most important ones, I guess, are the fact that Kevin King is here on our board, pinch hitting for Victor. Hi, Kevin. Thank you so much for being here. And even better, we have the digital Jesuit himself, Padre SJ, Father Robert Ballister, joining me for the show. Hi, Padre. How are you?
I'm fine. Oh. Thank you very much for having me. I don't think I've been on the show probably for more than a year and a half, maybe.
Oh, gosh. Has it been that long?
It's been a while, yeah.
And you don't have that much longer doing TWiT. We're obviously doing the TWiT crossover onto TWiL today. So if you want me to jump onto TWiT before you're out of here, I'd be happy to.
Absolutely. I'd love that. I love those crossover episodes, although I'm pretty sure they're going to continue after I'm gone. So no rush.
Good, good. Well, there's always a rush to hang out with you, Padre. Padre is here because, as I was saying, the force has been sort of bringing down all its weight on this episode of This Week in Law. My two regular co-hosts both have conflicts this week. And I just learned that one of them was out yesterday. But just an hour before we were to record this morning, our two guests, who are the co-founders of a Swiss startup that does smart contracts called Contract Vault, one of them has pneumonia and is in the hospital, and the other one has an emergency and can't be here. So we have some stories about smart contracts that I was hoping to go through with them today that we're definitely going to get into with them when they can come back on the show. What their company is doing is really interesting, and I think smart contracts in general are pretty interesting. So Padre and I are going to look at them a little bit. And then just to give in to where the force wants us to go, I think we'll talk about some Star Wars stuff and some Westworld stuff and get on out of here. So let's go ahead and start our smart contract
discussion. Denise, it's all good because all I need is Denise, the law, and a stream. This will be awesome. Smart contracts are fun.
That's exactly what we've got. So let's talk about those smart contracts.
I forgot about your epic bumpers.
Oh, the epic bumpers. Yes, of course. How could you forget? So people might not have heard of smart contracts, even if they have heard of Bitcoin and Ethereum and the blockchain. It's a little far removed from the other cryptocurrency discussions, but it's definitely a related point because one thing you can do with the blockchain, other than creating different kinds of currencies and forks in those currencies and all kinds of complexity, is you can put bits of information that otherwise might be in what we think of as a conventional legal contract, reduce them to code, put them on the blockchain, and then what winds up happening, sort of the dream of this, is the middlemen in the contract situation are eliminated. So a classic example would be purchasing a house. Money is paid for the house. Certain inspections and conditions have to be met in order for the money to be due. If those things are met, then the money changes hand, and so does the title to the property. And so you have an escrow company that oversees all those conditions in our world today. In a smart contract, the satisfaction of the conditions is actually distributed across the blockchain. And this is where I get a little fuzzy on it. I'm not sure how distributed nodes are going to be able to tell if your termite inspection came back appropriately. I guess from what I've read, having that reality come into place would mean you don't just have the transaction smart contract, you have a bunch of related smaller smart contracts involved too. And one would be the arrangements with the termite inspector. So, you know, once they satisfy their condition, again, that's something on the blockchain that's satisfied, checked off as a precondition to the overarching contract. So this is where we're going with these things. They have their pros and cons. Their cons right now involve certainly not being ready for prime time. And I'm really glad to have Padre here because he pays attention to enterprise tech. And this is something that I think enterprises will be very interested in once it's available. I'm wondering, Padre, sort of what the buzz around this is, you think, in the corporate world.
It's interesting because it's taken this long for us to educate people so that they can separate the blockchain from Bitcoin. Unfortunately, most of them still associate one with the other. You know, Bitcoin is a virtual currency, but the blockchain is so much more. Now, you know, you were doing an introductory bit on smart contracts, and smart contracts are just a way to take that traditional contract and give it a protocol so that you can emulate some of the same protections you would get out of a contract. As you mentioned, you know, you make a purchase. Well, there are certain stipulations that have to be met in order for that purchase to be valid. Well, if you break it down, if you break down a smart contract, and this is actually a conversation that we had at Enterprise Connect in Orlando, there's two things that you need. You need trackability and irreversibility. Those are the two things that you absolutely need in any sort of smart contract protocol, because you don't want someone to be able to go in and change the contract after the fact. And you also want a way for everyone to be able to see that that's the contract that was signed. Those are the stipulations that were agreed upon. And fortunately, the blockchain is incredibly good at both of those things. Everyone has a copy of the ledger, so everyone can see all the transactions that were made. And because everyone has a copy of the ledger, it's irreversible. You can't just edit one copy and then say, well, this is what we've got, because there's still as many copies out there in the world as you have nodes. So the two real parts of a smart contract are natural for the blockchain. I'm not surprised that companies would rush to combine smart contracts with blockchain technology.
Right. But as we were discussing, in the middle of that rush, there should be some brakes on this Kessel run, because things are not quite ready for people to get to the end that they hope to achieve right now. There are a couple of sort of glaring issues with the trust system that we already rely on in the world of contracts and breach of contracts. We touched on that briefly. I think that in order to have complex, or even I don't consider, you know, the purchase of a car or a home to be an incredibly complex transaction. It's something that happens millions of times a day around the world. But you could see just in those scenarios how you would need multiple smart contracts linked together in order to make sure that all the conditions had been satisfied. And then we have this good piece from Digital Trends about smart contracts that I encourage folks to check out if they're looking for more information in our Tagpacker links for the show. They point out that there's something called the Oracle problem. And that is that the smart contracts can't interact directly with the world if they're involved in real-world transactions where they have to verify something that you can't verify digitally. They need something called an oracle, an entity that's going to tell them that an event has taken place. So, as they point out in this piece, If what you're looking for is decentralization and security and transparency, once you bring an oracle into the equation, then you've effectively eliminated all of the benefits of decentralizing and putting things on the blockchain. You have a weak link that can be a point of failure. So that's something that they need to work out too, which is not yet fixed. Apparently, there's some kind of species of smart contract called a Ricardian contract that also that seems like it's trying to either address this oracle problem or is an example of it, maybe, where there are digital signatures involved in the contract as well. So it's definitely an interesting technology. I'm looking forward to having the Contract Vault guys on to talk about it more and talk about how they're addressing some of the early days issues in this burgeoning technology. One thing that has happened already is there has been a survey of a number of smart contracts already in existence. Something like 18,000 of them were examined, and over 8,000 of them were found to have had flaws that rendered them
legally
vulnerable.
Invalid, right?
Yeah, exactly. So,
well, see, that's the whole thing about this. Too many companies, I'm not saying that your guest did this, but too many companies have just added blockchain to their business plan, and they think that's all they have to do. We actually just had this exact same thing that you're talking about, the Oracle problem. We had that the last time I was in Rome. I was speaking with one of our institutions that distributes quite a bit of money to refugee camps and to third world nations that are doing projects. And there's been a massive problem with corruption. And a company approached them and said, look, we do blockchain ledgers and we can stop your corruption. And they sat down with me like, oh, this sounds very promising. And I was looking through this and saying, this doesn't make sense. The blockchain is not a corruption prevention technique. All the blockchain is a ledger. So even if you've got in the ledger that there was a transaction, there's nothing on the other side to say what happened with that transaction. Was the transaction valid? Should the transaction have been made? Should it have been made to that person? What happened to that money after the transaction was made? That can't be solved by the blockchain. And so any company that's going to create a smart contract or a smart ledger needs to have that. And that ultimately, that means you have to trust them. So that's that line of trust. Somewhere, there has to be someone that you trust to verify what's actually going into the blockchain. Because without that, the blockchain is just a list of possibly fanciful information.
Yes, exactly. And there's another good piece in our discussion points for the show by Lucinda Knapp. She's a writer at ethnews.com. Lengthy piece where she sort of incorporates lots of metaphors like being like bamboo, which flexes when you hit it and springs back with greater strength. She says that smart contracts aren't quite there yet. They don't flex, they break. And as far as that trust piece and verification piece, her skepticism, she lays out by saying, let me tell you about my roommate. And she tells about her roommate and her job. Her roommate is a nurse in her mid-50s who works for a health insurance company. And it's her job to go through all of the fine little data points without knowing you as a patient and deciding whether or not that battery of tests that your doctor wants to prescribe for you should be covered by your insurance, not just whether your insurance would cover those tests if they were necessary, but whether they are medically necessary. And so she has to go through and make that very difficult balancing situation where she looks at your family history and your medical history and considers whether or not, you know, you might be in jeopardy if you don't get these tests that your doctor thinks you should have. And she, you know, this is obviously the kind of very, very sensitive decision that people don't want to roll the dice on. And so her point is she's much more comfortable having her roommate, who she says understands you're a real person with a real life, and that you see out of the absolute center of your own unique little universe. And she, you know, she's the person that you're going to trust to make this good decision for you, even if you're not really aware that that person exists in the decision chain somewhere. So her ending line from that discussion is, which would you prefer, going over your major life choices, my roommate or a smart contract? So I think she's got a good point, and that we will. I'm sure that there are advocates, and I'm hoping when we have our founder guests on the show that they'll be able to sort of push back that on that a little bit and say, look, by distributing all the decision making and making it available for review on the blockchain, you do take that decision-making process out from behind the desk in the insurance company and make it visible and capable of evaluation. And maybe that's a benefit too. So,
well, I'm always going to be very wary of any new technology advocate who is saying, well, this will solve for X, Y, or Z. Because it almost never does. It's definitely a tool. It's something that we can use. It has some very unique properties. And I think that's true with the blockchain. A smart contract isn't going to get rid of a lawyer because the contract itself, as you mentioned, still has to be valid. It has to be legally sound before you put it into the blockchain. Just throwing a bunch of words on the blockchain doesn't mean, oh, that's the contract. You know, and that goes for everything that you might want to make smart by using a distributed ledger. Now, there's another issue here, and I really wanted to talk to your guest about this because I've been able to get no good answers. The way that a blockchain, any blockchain, is going to work is that it needs multiple nodes. The more nodes, the better, because it means the more distributed the ledger, which means the more resilient it is against tampering. Now, for a cryptocurrency like blockchain, I mean, like Bitcoin, there's an incentive to keep your node running because you can mine on that node and you can be paid certain fees or rewards for solving a proof of work.
Right.
In something like this, I don't hear any monetary incentive. So what is the incentive for someone to keep a node on to receive your blockchain if they're not being paid, if they don't have a stake in any of the legal contracts that are in that blockchain? And if it really is only a very small number, you know, if you've only got a couple of hundred, it's not really a distributed ledger. It's a very, very fragile ledger. So, you know, that's a very strange place to be with a technology, which is, it shows promise as long as people are willing to dedicate their time and their resources to it for nothing.
Right. Yeah. No, there would have to be some sort of pool of resources that would support those nodes. And we have another piece in our discussion points for the day that has to do with insurance, a smart contract insurance fund. Let's see. His name is Alex Van de Sande, if I'm pronouncing that right, has proposed an insurance pool that he thinks, now I don't know if it's directly addressing the situation you raised, Padre, but he thinks it will mitigate the risk of network splits stemming from a desire to recover funds frozen due to code faults in smart contracts. But I think, so he basically posits that you would set up a fund. The fund would be there for people who have issues. They could, if there are no issues, then the fund vanishes or goes back to its original contributors, I would imagine. But it is there to hedge against some of the downsides that can happen. And maybe something like that could be a way of funding some of the nodes that you're talking about, Padre. Although I don't think that's what he has in mind.
Well, I mean, there would have to be some sort of financial incentive. Let's get down to it. At the very minimum, people have to be able to make as much money as they're spending in electricity to have that node. Because, I mean, those get quite pricey. We've all read the stories. We know how much power Bitcoin is currently using up. Well, if you make any sort of blockchain with a proof of work, you'll be doing that because you could have millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of nodes all trying to do proof of work going flat out, which means they're using a lot of power. Well, unless you make that worth the while of the person running the node, they just won't run that node anymore. And if they don't run their node, that means that's one less copy, distributed copy of your ledger. Now, I actually like the story that you brought up because that's sort of the hybrid approach. It's, well, okay, what if we make a cryptocurrency do actual work, usable work, by storing a smart contract? Then the incentive system is already there. It's already in place. We just have to tap into it. We have to say, okay, for every smart contract you file, that's going to cost you X amount of money. And that X is your share of the financial reward for the people who are going to be doing that proof of work and therefore maintaining the distributed ledger. That actually could work. But too many of these startups that I see, and they all want me to come and see their brand new technology, it all comes back to, well, of course people are going to want to run it because everyone wants to be involved with the blockchain. It's like, yes, that's true. Until the bill comes and they say, I spent how much on electricity? No, turn that off.
And to your point too, there's money being spent right now for things like escrow and various other third-party intermediaries in transactions that could shift over and handle some of those expenses, I would imagine, and probably be more economical, that you'd be able to save money by doing your contract on Ethereum or using the Ethereum blockchain than you would by paying all the intermediaries you might have to ordinarily pay. So I don't know. It's very early days. Looking forward to getting our guests on when they can, the contract vault guys.
Denise, can I ask you a question? So as a lawyer, would you be okay with, let's say, 30 of the contracts that you've helped to draw up? Would you be okay with it being dropped onto a blockchain and everyone who has a copy of that ledger being able to go through your contracts word by word by word?
I would, as long as there were not confidentiality provisions in the contract. Sometimes parties contracting with one another don't want their arrangements to be viewable by the public. So that would not be a good use case for putting something on the blockchain, I guess, unless there were a way to secure who was able to review the terms. You could have the blockchain verify the satisfaction of the conditions, I guess, still.
Well, I mean, that's why, I wanted to talk to your guest because I wanted to see how would they solve for that, because there are some contracts that are confidential. So maybe you only see that the contract was submitted and that a third party verified that the conditions were met, but you don't actually get to see the clauses in the contract.
And even contracts that aren't confidential in their terms, they don't contain a confidentiality clause or some sort of NDA. Do you want someone being able to just pull up at the drop of a hat what you paid for your house? I mean, I guess maybe we live in that world already, and I'm being naive because real estate comps are readily available and deeds are recorded, and it does feel like, you know, oh, so anyone can see what I paid for the house or the car or whatever. It does seem like there's some personal information involved in a lot of contracts that people enter into, loans that they've taken out, et cetera, that you would need to build some sort of confidentiality into the process. And I know that one of the things that our future guests will be able to address, you know, they called their company Contract Vault. So there's some sort of security assurance that I think they're building into what they're doing, and I'll be interested to explore that with them, why they're called their company Contract Vault rather than Fun with Smart Contracts or whatever.
It really is
fascinating, whatever their alternate names were.
I don't want to be a Luddite here. I'm just saying, okay, you know, there's a lot that has to be done after you call yourself blockchain whatever, you know, smart contract whatever. Good idea. There's definitely promise here. I don't see it just yet, but that's just me. That's just me.
Well, it's something to watch for sure. Definitely, you know, Mike Arrington, the founder of TechCrunch, bought, I believe, the first piece of real estate in the world to be purchased through a smart contract on the Ethereum blockchain when he purchased a condo in the Ukraine for something in the range of $35,000. So again, it wasn't all self-executing. There were I think to comply with Ukrainian law, they had some people, they had lawyers on the back end and some of the more conventional aspects to what we would think of as a real property contract. But, you know, it was interesting and headline making, and I'm sure not the last of its kind.
I'd love to get one of our legal experts from Santa Clara University down the road to talk about how this might change curriculum in a law school. That when you teach your students smart contracts, they mm-hmm. now have to write a contract that can survive the scrutiny of being put on a public ledger. That's a different kind of pressure.
Yes,
because everyone will pick it apart. Everybody will look at it and go, oh no, this was poorly written and this is a bad clause. And so, more review, which is good for us. I mean, if you're looking for this kind of work to be done for you, the fact that that work will be under more scrutiny, I think that can only be a positive, right?
Right. And we see a preview of that or a species of that right now with all of the contracts that govern our interactions and relationships with websites. Of course, those are all public. They're privacy policies and terms of service, and people do pick them apart and rate them and all kinds of requirements about how to notify users if they are modified and things like that. So,
yeah,
bit of a preview. All right, let us move on. It is May the 4th, after all, and I don't know how we're going to get through an episode of This Week in Law without paying homage to Star Wars Day. We have a few law-related Star Wars stories to share with you. First off, this isn't really law-related, but we were making it law-related before the show, and we should continue on with that discussion. Padre noticed, as did I this morning, and I'm sure lots of you, that Heathrow Airport turned one of its departure arrival screens into a Star Wars themed experience where you could journey off to various points in the Star Wars universe, but not Alderaan. The flight to Alderaan was canceled.
That was so sad. It really was. And you know, I love this. It's playful. It's fun. I'm sure, I'm absolutely positive that there were some people who were upset because they were confused by what they saw and they're not Star Wars fans. And okay, that's fine. But I did have a question about using something like this, which is, it's definitely a property owned by Disney mm-hmm. in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, if you look at this picture, that's definitely a TIE fighter. And some of the other pictures, they've got icons from things like from Red Squadron. Those are copyrighted, and you're not supposed to be able to use that without permission, right? How about like even the names? The names are made up names. They're fictional names made up just in the Star Wars universe. Can you use those without getting the express permission, written permission of Disney?
Yes, it's an interesting question. And of course, Disney is pretty well known for being zealous about its intellectual property. And you're right, there are copyright concerns, trademark concerns in doing this. And I doubt that Heathrow went to Disney and licensed anything or got their go ahead. But as you were pointing out, Padre, I wonder if Disney really wants that kind of backlash.
When I was still working in Hawaii, in Honolulu, we had a grammar school. It was a Catholic grammar school. And a bunch of sixth graders had painted a mural of their favorite Disney princesses and Star Wars characters. And it was sixth grade art, but it was very cool. Disney actually filed suit against the school to take it down. They had to paint over it. And I was thinking, that's a weird fight to pick. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. So I understand they can enforce wherever they feel like they should enforce, but it always feels a little arbitrary to me about where they're going to strike.
Exactly. And that's the nature of copyright law, right? The rights holders get to decide when they're going to enforce or not. Intellectual property law in general is like that. And there could be, as you were pointing out before the show, Padre, a parody defense yeah. that could be urged to some of these claims. But especially if Heathrow had originated the idea of saying, oh, the flight to Alderaan has been canceled. But as soon as we mentioned that that was part of the sign, Dr. Morbius in chat noticed what I noticed as well, living down the road from Disneyland as I do, that when you are waiting in line for Star Tours, there is a very similar arrival and departures board.
Oh, my goodness. I completely forgot about that. I haven't been to Disneyland probably in about 27 years.
Right.
But yeah, I remember this was before the era of phones with cameras. But I remember taking I took a picture and I had to develop it on film, Denise. I don't know if you can believe this, but we had these little squares of plastic that you would expose and then the picture would come on and then you would expose that to paper and you get a picture. It was amazing.
It was.
Incredible technology.
Yes.
Oh, but okay. So that's not original, but, and this is a question I've always had. How strongly does a company need to defend its copyright so that in the future, someone can't argue, well, they kind of abandoned the copyright because they never defended it.
Not strongly at all. Okay. No, you don't.
It's pretty bulletproof.
You don't lose it by not enforcing it. It stays and you can enforce it when you choose to. So let's see if Disney, I really would be stunned if Disney decided to rain all over Heathrow Airport's parade.
Yeah.
They get enough rain there in London as it is. So, and it's, I think that Disney must, you know, look at a lot of the stuff that happens on May 4th every year and just go, you know, it builds our brand. It's wonderful. It's enthusiastic and we're going to roll with it. One thing that our friends over at the Legal Geeks blog do is try and pull out the legal conundrum in things like Star Wars. And of course, here on May 4th, they did not disappoint. Thomas Harper over there has a post called Royal Captive, The Legality of Princess Leia's Imprisonment, where he considers whether Leia is truly a prisoner of war and talks about, you know, how various protections in our real world have built up over the years to make sure that soldiers captured in battle are not mistreated as they have been throughout history.
She did kill a stormtrooper when they were trying to arrest her. So, I mean,
yes,
she might be on shaky legal ground there.
She might. Well, I mean, he goes through and does this actually very thoughtful post where he considers that she might be able to classify herself as something called a belligerent diplomat, which is someone who is holding a political office and a member of an armed force, and they have some sort of, you know, legal diplomatic protection. But no, that's not what Leia did. And he points out, you know, if someone thought this through, how that's a very brave move on her part, because if she had invoked some sort of belligerent diplomat protection, that would have basically been her copping to the Alliance being involved with Alderaan and basically
hold on a second, because she was smuggling plans for the Death Star, which would make her guilty of espionage. And if she was a spy, I think it's in the Geneva Convention, spies are not given the same protection as a prisoner of war.
That's correct. So this is his point, is that what she did was throw herself under the bus as a possible slash probable spy, rather than ratting out, you know, her family and her planet and the government of Alderaan as, you know, with her as representative. That really, it's just on her the situation that she put herself in. Leia therefore lied to Vader's face, not because she honestly thought he would buy it, but because it was part of her last full measure to protect her people and the rebellion, he writes. So, interesting.
I love this. Point. But yes. I will point out that this means that all these years we have been rooting for a spy and a war criminal.
This is true. Desperate times, desperate measures, Padre. Let's see. The other hysterical thing I saw this morning is the Palm Beach Sheriff's Department in Florida just threw out a tweet that said, "Above the law, no one is. Obey the law, you must." With Yoda looking very Yoda-like.
Although that's the point at which Yoda raises not the fighter, but R2-D2 in the air. So,
Another really, really fun thing that happened this week, sort of in honor of all of this, is in Vilseck, Germany, which is a U.S. Army base populated by the families of U.S. soldiers. So they have a school, and also by the JAG Corps, the Judge Advocates General Corps, Judge Advocate General Corps, who are lawyers who work for the military. And so I guess this is not the first time they have done something similar, but they put on a mock trial using fourth grade students as the lawyers and witnesses, and and they had help from the JAG Corps. And the whole point was to put Luke Skywalker on trial as a potential terrorist for blowing up the Death Star.
Okay. And, yes. I mean, this reaches back into my when you were in high school, did you ever do like speech and debate, mock Congress or mock trials?
I didn't do any of that until I was in law school.
Oh, yeah. I loved doing that as a kid. That was, I mean, it was so much fun. I mean, yeah, some of it was definitely not courtroom ready, but you at least got to see how how both sides of the aisle worked in a courtroom.
Right.
It was fun. It was fun.
And that's what these kids got to do. They were the defense team too, had to be very nimble here. They were proceeding along trying to defend Luke Skywalker, but at first by saying that he couldn't be identified. It would be extraordinarily difficult to correctly pick out the identity of the pilot of a standard X-Wing fighter spacecraft like the one flown by Skywalker from miles away, traveling at thousands of miles per hour. So they were doing a pretty good job of making a case that there would be reasonable doubt that the defendant on trial was actually the perpetrator of the crime. But then they were thrown a curveball in the middle of trial when Luke Skywalker, the student playing Luke Skywalker, confessed. I blew up the Death Star. And so then they had to shift gears and make the argument that it was a justifiable act because of all the mayhem that the Death Star already had perpetrated to poor Alderaan and was bound to do in the future. So they actually won their trial. Luke was found innocent. And Mark Hamill came along and acknowledged them and acknowledged all the lawyers and witnesses by name, fourth grade kids, thanked his defense team, called their defense brilliant and wise. It was us or them, he characterized it. And he said many lives were saved. So that had to have been super fun for them. And also, I don't know how they managed it, but the student who portrayed Darth Vader, his name is Xavier Maul.
I know. I was reading that going, that can't be true, right? That's a made up name. No. Now, nope. By the way, Mark Hamill, his Luke Skywalker is probably my second favorite character by Mark Hamill, which I know is going to shock some people. The first character that he does is voice only. He does the Joker from the animated series of Batman, and he's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So just go watch that. I know it's the fourth, but go spend some time with Batman, the animated series, and tell me that he's not brilliant in that series.
I have definitely seen some clips of that, and yeah, he's chilling.
He's incredibly good.
Yeah.
And I did not know. I watched that series for years and had no idea it was him until he actually owned up to it, and I was blown away. It does not sound like him at all.
All right. The great body of work that is Mark Hamill. Okay, so that's about what we've got to discuss for this episode of This Week in Law, except for our ever popular concluding material for the show. I think that I'm well in need of an animal selfie of the week.
Yes, please. When did they have time to make these things, and why don't they make them for our other shows?
You have to ask, Padre.
That's amazing.
A bunch of our show's interns made most of them. However, the animal selfie one was crafted with love right there in the studio.
Aw.
Yes, and I'm not sure, does that little animal that stars in that bumper have a name?
That started out, it's Patrick Delahanty's. That started out as the raccoon that Kevin Rose threw down his stairs because it was attacking his dog, and then became
the
Rocket.
The actual one?
Well, no, it was he brought it in at when Kevin Rose came into the studio to talk about that story. And now it's Rocket Raccoon from Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you, Rocket. We enjoy you every week. And the animal we're going to highlight as our animal selfie this week. You know that the animal selfie case, the famous animal selfie, monkey selfie case, Padre, was finally resolved last week.
Oh,
we
yes.
don't think that it will breathe another breath.
There's not going to be another appeal here?
I don't think so, but you never know. I don't see the Supreme Court wanting to get involved in what the Ninth Circuit had to say here. So if PETA knows what's good for them, they'll take their candy and go home. But that doesn't mean we're not going to keep featuring animal selfies because the copyright ramifications of them are so, so fun and possibly have broader implications for creations by non-animal intelligences as we advance forward into our world of smart contracts and AI and everything else. This week, we've got Norm the Pug. Norm has a wonderful Instagram account. Let's see. Aww. Isn't he super cute?
He is
the selfie pug on Instagram. His papa is a photographer named Jeremy Veach, if I'm saying that correctly. And Norm is one of our favorite kinds of animal selfie, an animal that is actually taking the selfies himself.
He's pushing
the button? he is somehow activating the shutter on whatever is taking this in most instances. I think
that one might be a little bit of a stretch.
Yes,
for that. Yeah.
That one I in the dryer, I don't think he actually orchestrated, but most of them he does. And so it's just super cute. He must have been trained to reach out and hit the shutter. I don't know if it's
hit the shutter, get a treat. That's how it works.
Shutter, get a treat. So Norm the Pug is very cute. And in fact, it's cute enough that he rated his very own BuzzFeed piece in that's got just one of the classic BuzzFeed headlines, 24 reasons Norm the Pug is the coolest pug you will ever meet in your life. And I really can't argue with that. Our tip of the week is going to go back to the Legal Geeks, who before they wrote about Star Wars this week, wrote about Westworld. Have you been watching the new iteration, Padre?
I have saved all of Westworld and a couple of other series for when I move to Rome and I get tired of Italian television.
There you
I'm
go.
Serious about that. I need something, and that's going to be my job. I haven't watched any episode. Everyone here has told me how wonderful it is, so that's definitely on my binge list.
Are you fluent in Italian?
No, at all.
You had to think about how to say no in Italian just then.
There will have to be some serious intensive Italian lessons coming up in the very near future.
Yes. Well. When you do decide to forge into Westworld, no spoilers here. Well, actually, it is a spoiler, so
that's
you
okay.
might want
I'm spoiler
proof. Your ears.
You could tell me exactly how it happens, and I will still watch it because I'm all about the story.
All right. Well, no one else get angry with me if you haven't. If you saw the end of last season, you're aware of the fact that one of the main characters in the show, who we've thought was human all along, turns out not to be. Turns out to be one of the finely crafted hosts that populate Westworld. And so the folks over at the Legal Geeks, specifically Caesar Kalinowski IV, scratched his head about this one and went, if someone creates a doppelganger of me, what sort of legal rights do I have? So that's our tip of the week. What you may want to consider doing if you find that there is an android doppelganger of yourself wandering around in the world, what sort of things you might want to claim. And Caesar is quick to point out that much like blockchain has a long way to go, our current laws have a long way to go before they are able to address this particular situation. But you might want to start with things like fraud and identity theft, and then move on to criminal impersonation, which exists in many states, and also various civil liberty, civil remedies that you might be able to pursue if someone has taken something from you of value. That would be conversion, which is called, it's the civil version of theft. So various claims you might be able to pursue if you find yourself walking around in Westworld and you don't remember being there. How might that have happened? We have two resources of the week for you. One is a piece in The Atlantic and a reminder that really every December and January, it's a good time to check what works, what copyrighted works are going to escape U.S. copyright and enter the public domain. And so Glenn Fleischman over at The Atlantic is already looking ahead to next January and has checked in with the folks at Duke University's law school. They have a Center for the Study of Public Domain there. And they've pointed out that we have various things coming. Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments, Padre, is going to enter the public domain next January 1st. So if you've been waiting for your chance to remix that one with impunity, that is coming. Also, Charlie Chaplin's film The Pilgrim.
Okay, that's huge. That's a big one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We've got some compositions by Bela Bartok, Aldous Huxley's Antic Hay, Winston Churchill's The World Crisis, Carl Sandburg's Rutabaga Pigeons, E.E. Cummings' Tulips and Chimneys, Noel Coward's London Calling musical, that's a big one, Edith Wharton's A Son at the Front, and many stories by P.G. Wodehouse. So lots of good stuff entering the public domain next year, and a good reminder to you know, if you're a creative person or someone who is just interested in old literature or films, if you would like to get your hands on public domain versions of those things, each year there's sort of a big party that happens when these very old works do fall out of copyright. And then our second resource of the week is a reminder, and this is not the first time that we've talked about something like this. We feature animal selfies every week on the show, but we have something here related to travel and a reminder to just be responsible in your travels, in your pursuit of your very own perfect animal selfies, that oftentimes experiences are set up for tourists involving animals and giving them the opportunity to photograph themselves with animals that are not necessarily treating the animals as well as we would like them to be treated. So in Brazil, for example, there's a photo here of a pink river dolphin in the Amazon that is attracted with food and then used as a photo prop for the tourists that are there. And they're kind of all around it. And I would imagine if you're a pink river dolphin, that might not be the best situation. The other thing that this article pointed out that I hadn't really thought about before is, you know, oftentimes you're traveling and There are opportunities to jump on a camel in front of the pyramids of Giza, or donkey rides at Blackpool Beach in the UK, horse rides just about anywhere, mule rides, etc. It just bears keeping in mind that you want to make sure that the animals that are you're encountering on your vacations are properly cared for and not, you know, deprived of food and water or made to work too hard. Of course, elephants that you encounter in the world are something that you should pay particular attention to, etc. So there's this good piece at stuff.co.nz about animal welfare for travelers. That's also in our discussion points for this episode of This Week in Law. And anything else on your mind, Padre, before we go ahead and wrap up the show?
Not really. I think, you know, I'm sad that we couldn't have a full length episode with some fantastic guests, but maybe next time, who knows?
Yeah, absolutely. They have promised me they're going to get back in touch when things are less chaotic and less unhealthful for them. And we'll get them back on, and we will definitely be back next week. And so soldier ahead here with This Week in Law. I've been pondering titles for this sort of strange abbreviated episode. And in honor of Star Wars Day, I think what I've come up with is Doing Not.
We were thinking, what was it? A lawyer, a priest, and a shark boy walk into a podcast or something like that.
I do like that.
Might be too long.
Yeah, probably. All right. Well, we very much appreciate your being with us, Padre, and Kevin as well on the board, and all of you. It's always fun to come and see our peeps. Oh, Padre, more importantly, have you gotten tickets to the Solo film yet?
No, unfortunately, I will be out of the country when that rolls around.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, won't you be able to see it in Italy?
With Italian audio. I tried doing that this last time. It was not conducive to a fun time. I think I'll be watching most of my films on DVD from now on.
All right. Well, I'm going to be thinking good thoughts for you and hoping that your Italian lessons proceed apace so that you can go see Solo and understand what's going on.
Always a pleasure, Denise. Always a pleasure.
Yes. Great to see you. Great to have all of you join us for This Week in Law. We record the show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1900 UTC. We hope that you can join us live if that works with your schedule. But if you can't, go ahead and head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is there for you to enjoy at your pleasure on your device of choice through your personal assistant of choice. However, wherever you join us, we're thrilled that you do. And we're happy to hear from you between the shows as well. So you should hit me up on Twitter. I'm D Howell there. Padre is Padre SJ there, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And so definitely as you're cruising through your infotainment diet, let us know what you see that you think we should discuss on the show, unpack a little further. Let us know guests you think we should invite on the show, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, you can email me too. I'm Denise@twit.tv. And you're still Padre at twit.tv, correct?
That's correct. It's all for the next couple of weeks. I'm Padre at twit.tv. Easiest place to reach me, though, is twitter.com/PadreSJ. And if you follow me there, you get to see what I'm doing when I'm not in the studio, which is a lot more these days. I may have to take another trip overseas in about 3 weeks. We'll see.
Oh goodness. Well, Padre, it's so great to have the chance to hang out with you before you do embark to a higher calling, quite literally. It's just been so great to hang out with you over the years.
Yeah, I know. Twill was one of the first podcasts I guested on when I came into the Twit TV network, so it has a special place in my heart. And of course, Denise, you're always welcome to visit me. We have plenty of guest rooms. I've been making this offer to all the Twit hosts. If you feel like coming to Rome, our front door is 90 seconds from St. Peter's.
Oh, I'm so excited. You know, and I mentioned this last week, a friend of mine has written a book that is coming out later this month, and he asked me to do the audio for it. So I've been doing the audio narration of it, and we're trying to get that done in time for his book launch. But the first chapter, Padre, has people clandestinely breaking into St. Peter's.
We don't have to clandestinely do it. I've got a key.
There we go. There we go. Yes. Yes. All right. Well, I would definitely love to get your Vatican tour at some point in time. We'll have to take you up on that one. And really, all the best.
Thank you. Thank you. And you haven't seen the last of me. You know I'm going to be coming back. I love Twit.
Good. We love you too. All right, everyone. We will see you next week on This Week in Law. Take care.